This is audio stage. In the performing arts, our work is mortal. This is something we're acutely aware of within our practice, something that we incorporate into the very definition of our art form, live performance.
But how do you record performance? After all, it is defined by a moment of presence. Peggy Phelan said it most definitively. The only life of performance is in the present. Performance cannot be saved, recorded, documented. Performance becomes itself through disappearance.
The danger lies in losing all record of what came before us, leaving artists to operate, in the words of Julian Merrick, as if theatre was a terra nullius, to be populated exclusively by the latest trends and stage styles, without any awareness that we've been here before or that our art is part of an ongoing cultural heritage. We are floating in uncharted waters. Today, we're going to talk about some of that heritage, its preservation, and how it influences our work. I'm Fleur Kilpatrick.
And I'm Jana Bergovic.
And welcome to the second episode of Audio Stage. And today we're talking about performing arts histories.
And our guest today is Alison Krogan. Hello.
Hello, Jana. Hello, Fleur.
Alison Krogan had been a Melbourne newspaper critic, a controversial one as well, a poet and a very successful author of a series of young adult fantasy books when on the 4th of June 2004 she wrote on the internet, "One day it struck me that a blog that focused on theatre criticism would be a most interesting thing to do."
Indeed it was.
And so began her blog Theatre Notes, which will become the single most important publication for theatre criticism in Australia. And by the time Theatre Notes retired at the end of 2012, Alison was considered Australia's single most important theatre critic, and she still is.
Why?
I think.
Thank you, Jana. That sounds very intimidating. And I think sort of continues some of the problems I sense around the whole question of criticism that you were suggesting in the introduction about what happens when you have authority speaking about what happened in the theatre. And I suppose one of the things is, yes, it must be recorded, otherwise it's all lost. Mm. And we must have a cultural memory. But one of the things that haunted me when I was doing theatre works was the work that I didn't cover.
Yeah.
The works that I didn't go to.
That suddenly, because Alison Krogan's Theatre Notes hasn't represented that, and when it's held up in that sort of esteem, it becomes
problematic. Because I, you know, luckily there were other blogs and other conversations going on. But at the same time, if it's there as an archive now, and if people assume it's a total archive, I'm really aware of all the really excellent work that I didn't see that isn't in that archive.
Absolutely.
And so I suppose part of that thing is, in any review that's being taken as a history, what is not being said, what is not being written down, what is not recorded, what isn't even noticed, even if you're doing your best.
Now, I'm going to start with a provocation. So this is such a trope. The Australian theatre doesn't know its own history. Nobody, in fact, knows Australian theatre history, but the theatre itself doesn't know it. You know, it feels sometimes like we work in a field in which, you know, when we look back behind us, there's only a lot of faintly grey fog. Sort of. Nobody knows where we're
Alison
from.
Just pulled a very protesting face, but let's go on.
But so if I asked, tell me the potted history of the Australian theatre in 2 minutes. Your time starts now.
Oh, how unfair you are, Jan.
What would you tell me?
I've never pretended to be a theatre historian or a performance historian. But I would take issue. When I started as a critic when I was 27, you know, blithely ignorant of many, many things, but with a huge hunger to find out, you know, like what's happened. You know, I found myself more and more interested in this form that I was kind of being drawn towards by all sorts of chance meetings and jobs and things that happened. And back then, trying to find out a history of Australian theatre, really there was not much in terms of, you know, like even things like the Pram Factory, which is still not properly documented. But now that has improved. It's not like there's a desert. There are books, there are memoirs, there are records, there are libraries full of things, people who've I can't remember the site on the internet that lists every performance. Mm. So there are records if you dig and look, and companies have archives and take recordings. And so that, there are things now that weren't the case, say, 30 years ago.
I would, however, say that the very fact that you say, oh, I'm not a historian, points to the trouble there. You wrote February 10, 2005, Alison Crogan wrote, if memory is a form of consciousness, then Australian theatre as a discrete, if debatable, entity is a dead duck. We barely have a repertoire. How often do we see reinterpretations of classic texts by White, Hewitt, Bennion, Kenner, Hibbert, I don't even know who Bennion is, or any other playwright who has made a mark in the past 50 years, and how many new plays have any life beyond a single four-week season?
That's absolutely... I actually read that on the way in because you mentioned Julian Merrick's Trapped in the Past platform paper. And so I thought, oh, yes, I did write about that. So luckily remember where that quote came from. And, yes, that was in 2004, before the Playbox became the Malthouse. I think things have shifted since then, but we do have the ongoing thing of, you know, people write plays, they get put on, there's no touring or remounting, and so the most that, say, most productions can expect to have is a four-week season, perhaps. So that kind of memory, yes, that's still a problem, but I don't think it's as much as it was. I think it was a real problem back in my 20s, which is, you know, decades ago now.
Well, this is because we have theatre notes.
It's not just theatre notes, there are other resources too. And people have written books and published books since then that I wish they had been out when I was looking for them.
I think people have also become acutely aware of this gap of knowledge and have become more concerned about that and are talking about that in a much more open way.
Yeah, I think so. So, it's all comparative because, of course, it could be much better. But it's kind of interesting at looking at Next Wave at the moment, say, where there seems to be an awful lot of dialogue, particularly in the visual arts, between generations. There's an exhibition at Gertrude Street which is kind of looking at traditions of performance art and or performative art, and they're bringing in, you know, actually into that space some famous performance art performances that have been lost, but they're being restaged by the artist, but they will obviously be different. And so I think you're right, there's much more of an awareness.
Just today, Chris Mead was saying in a lecture that our performance culture is very young, and he was absolutely talking post Summer of the 17th Doll when he was saying this, so ignoring the 150 years that Rob Reed was talking about just last week. But he was saying our culture is still so young that if we wanted to, the majority of these people we could track down and talk to. A lot of these people are still there to have conversations with if the younger performers and makers are expressing a desire to have those conversations. That's there.
Yeah, but is it true anyway? Because one of the aspects is 30,000-year culture of Indigenous performance.
Which
still plays very much into contemporary performance. And then the things that Julian Merrick was saying about Entrapped in the Past, about all the forgotten history pre the 60s, that it, to answer your very first question, Jana, you know, the general narrative is that we were a colonial culture where nothing much happened except, you know, plays from England, and then along came a surge of nationalism in the 60s and 70s and boom, we had an Australian theatre. And Julian Merrick's argument is it actually wasn't that simple. There are all sorts of complex things that happened before then that were about making Australian theatre, and they've been forgotten in that kind of myth. To all our detriment, really. We should remember all these things.
Robert Reed talked about a very successful commercial sector that existed that was very much supplanted by a funded, not so very popular, so artistic sector. And there's, of course, the history of circus, say, which is a very old form in Australia.
And vaudeville and things like that.
What do you think is the consequence of that narrative on theatre in Australia?
For a while it made theatre really dull. There was a dominant myth, and it was a nationalistic myth, and it was very male myth, and it was a very writer-centric narrative. And what I found when I was, again, young and talking to people, one of the I've started off as a journalist, basically, and I ended up just by chance, again, interviewing a lot of people and then having later conversations where you just found things out because you were interested. And, you know, like the feminist theatre that was happening in the 70s and also some plays by Peter Hunke, some of their first English language performances were on in Melbourne. And so there was a whole lot of forgotten history that people talked about but was never written down. And it was a much more interesting and much more complex picture than the one that was kind of presented. But, of course, one of the things I think what I particularly responded to in Julian's paper was he talked about pitched battles between different camps in the culture. And that was something I certainly experienced in Australian poetry, which a friend of mine described as a knife fight in a phone box. And it was very accurate. That's particularly vicious in the 60s and 70s. And there were similar kinds of fights in the theatre, though I think it was slightly bigger than the phone box. And I've always felt really allergic to that because it's a way of just erasing interesting developments and interesting arguments and interesting differences. So there's ways in which these conflicts were not illuminating. And I think one of the things Julian was calling for was a mutual recognition across different camps that weren't just simply about erasing the other side and winning whatever it was you were supposed to win.
Well, I think it's interesting that Theatre Notes, because it has remained such a comprehensive record of about 10 years of theatre debates, it will remain as a record of some very interesting culture wars, shall we say, within theatre. And I wrote a whole list just by looking very briefly through your blog. So there is playwright versus director, excellence versus shock. You know, there is Peter Craven and Shakespeare here versus Barry Kosky and Marius von Meinberg on the other side. There is naturalism versus non-naturalism. And then there is you versus Len Radick and Cameron Woodhead and Peter Craven and Robin Usher and Raymond Gill. And all of these people versus Christy Edmonds, who was the artistic director of the Melbourne International Arts Festival between 2005 and 2008 and attracted an incredible hostility for her artistic choices.
Bizarrely.
But it seemed like you were very much aligned with the non-naturalism, with the poetry of stage, that you very much championed the work of artists such as Michael Cantor and Barry Kosky, of course, and Benedict Andrews and Marius von Meinberg, and argued against theatre as this text-based, worthy thing, you know, that's about good issues. And
yes, I mean, that's what some people certainly said. And I would say, because again, that's going back to that awful dichotomy. I love plays. I love text-based theatre. I'm a writer, and I think that language in the theatre matters enormously. I was and remain hostile to a certain kind of, if you like, issue-based theatre that was called naturalism. It wasn't actually naturalism. That was, for me, incredibly boring and was about kind of particularly, I mean, again, all these things are historically situated because what I felt was that there was all this interesting work happening in Melbourne and in Australia generally and all these really interesting artists who were routinely marginalised in a way that is probably hard to quite get now, but there was this thing called the mainstream, and it was that kind of play, and it was always a play. It was always a conservative ideology in the play, even if it claimed not to be faintly left-wing, but, you know, liberal in a way. And that always got the attention and the notice and the history, if you like. And then the other stuff, not all of it was good, but there was always been some very brilliant work going on under the skin in Australia. In other places, that work would get noticed. In this country, it just didn't. And I suppose I felt really strongly about that because I saw so many artists who were kind of destroyed by that, that just simply that they might as well have not have bothered. And that seemed to me really dreadful, that there wasn't at least someone looking and saying, my goodness, what have you done here, this amazing thing. And so Theatre Notes was explicitly about wanting to somehow address that, what I saw as that imbalance.
I was actually talking to Ming Zhu He about that recently, yeah, because she said there was no independent theatre practically in Melbourne until about 2000 and I think 5 or 6, she said. This was in a private conversation. I said, no. What I thought had happened was that blogs happened.
Yes, exactly.
And
right.
So suddenly this work was actually seen and written about.
There's always been independent theatre in Melbourne.
And I really think that you championed and really have been very important in promoting the work of people like Daniel Schlusser,
yeah,
and Sisters Grimm in particular, whose first early shows are legendary, but they had very small audiences. These yeah. were all backyard shows. And to some extent, Angus Sereny.
Yeah, but there's, I mean, these were also people who come out of older traditions of Australia, Melbourne performance in particular, all of those artists do. So it's kind of interesting, there's continuities that remain hidden very often. And yeah, it's a terrible thing to have the impression that there was no independent theatre in Melbourne before 2005, because Melbourne was where the independent theatre happened. It just always was, from the Pram Factory and through La Mama in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, that's a whole history that then is forgotten, and that's dreadful.
In the most recent issue of The Overland, you wrote of history, we live in a culture in which literacy is privileged, often savagely, at the expense of other kind of knowledge, citing as well that one of the big reasons that the European colonisers were able to dismiss Indigenous culture was that it was an oral culture and that there wasn't something concrete and written. And I think that this is really pertinent to your line of work as a theatre critic, because more so than with literary criticism, performance criticism becomes almost the most concrete form of documentation of a work, particularly when scripts are published so seldom in Australia. And I know this is something you've given a lot of thought to and seen you write about this as well.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to balance these roles as archivalist, and in some ways mainstream print media is almost against that role, where often a lot of the time they have a word limit, they have a deadline, a very short turnaround, they have star ratings, and you've written as well recently, to score a show out of 5 erases nuance and funnels a review to judgment. It ignores something important in the duty of a critic to his or her public. If you consider, as I do, the major arm of the critic's task is to be a hinge between the artwork and its audience, opening doors to possibility and understanding, then much of our critical discourse is failing. I love this, but could you talk a bit about the difficulties of balancing those dual roles as critic to both pass judgment in a way and archive?
I mean, when I first started, a huge influence on me was an American critic called Robert Brustein, who taught at Yale, and he was he wrote criticism for the New Republic, I think. I'm not entirely sure about that, but I had several of his books, Who Needs Theatre, and I found his criticism really interesting. There were long reviews, and often quite tough, and they were great to read. So I was my first reaction as a young critic was to go and read a whole lot of critics. And so, of course, I read Tynan, and Billington's collected reviews came out. And those collections, Catherine Brisbane's collected reviews, they're really important records of certain bits of histories. And they give you an idea. Really good ones do give you an idea of what it was like in that culture, even if it's a partial idea, because it's one person responding in their way and you get to know their sensibility through that, and I really like that. And the thing about Robert Brustein was that he has some very articulate arguments for that kind of criticism. He got really bored with the judgment thing. He thought that was just, he was going to the theatre, he was reading criticism about that and reviews, and he's going, well, that's actually not really that interesting. It's not an interesting thing to read. It's not an interesting way to respond to the work that he was seeing. And he wanted something that was sort of, as he put it, more useful. He was a huge influence on what I wanted to do with Theatre Notes when I started. This sense that something that is responsive, of course it's going to make judgment. We all make judgments when we go to the theatre. We all have our own sensibilities. And I think we must acknowledge that there's no such thing as an objective judgment. And nor should there be, because it would be intensely dull way of kind of talking about and experiencing art, you know. I mean, Jana and I argue all the time. We're arguing on Twitter this afternoon. and that makes it much more, you know, much more interesting.
It's also because your response to art is so emotive, and you've also spoken of the necessity for that as well, that art is an emotive form.
I wanted to ask you about the historical damage that an incorrect review does. When I was starting out as a performance critic, I had a conversation with a dancer. This was in Vienna, 2008, and I was asking this dancer about how, you know, what he wants from critics when they review his work. And he said to me, he looked at me exasperated, and he said, look, I really don't care if it's positive or negative. I would just really like it to be accurate. And that was very important for me at the time. I remember thinking to myself, wow, I'm going to be the accurate critic. But in November 2006, you came home after Requiem for the 20th Century, a show at Theatre at Risk, and you walked out.
It's all online.
You walked out, and then you wrote about Cameron Woodhead's review in The Age, which wasn't just positive, it was, in your words, a rave. And this, it's quite interesting because you don't just say this person is wrong. You say the fact that this person is wrong so publicly is actually damaging for all of us. Do you remember that?
I certainly remember that. And a lot of people were very angry with me, A, for walking out, and B, for then writing about it, which I wasn't going to. And, of course, we're all told that critics shouldn't write about things that they've only seen half of. And of course, that is true and correct, and we shouldn't. But I have on occasion.
But you didn't even write about a work. You wrote about the damage that this review is going to do. And would you like to expand on that?
Okay. Memories. I'm not sure I can defend my decision then. I wouldn't do it now. But I was furious. I was furious with the show. I thought the show was just so appalling. And I could not believe that Cameron had given it such a positive review. And I thought, I think at the time I felt that it was like a kind of travesty of theatre. I'm not saying I would say that now, mind you. But doing that and making what was for me a night of really, really teeth-achingly boring theatre. And then, obviously, Cameron didn't think this, you see. I've had to learn to be more tolerant.
I actually was there. I enjoyed the show very much.
I loathed it. I felt really sorry for Walter Benjamin, who was in the show. And so, people would go along expecting something exciting from that, and I thought his review was totally misrepresented. It certainly did not represent my experience in the show, and like I said, I wouldn't say that now. Because, of course, everybody has different experiences of theatre.
But you do make a very interesting point there. And this, of course, was what created one of those great discussions that Theatre Notes had, you know, a couple of times a year. And you said, I hope that the crew at Theatre at Risk would take stock, review how it happened, that they had worked so hard and devoted so many hard-won resources on a work of such monumental silliness, and think again.
But
you felt that Cameron Woodhead's review would inoculate them from such stock taking that they would the message wouldn't get across. And then you also said, what about those audience members who are encouraged by the review, go and see the show, and then it sucks, and then they leave thinking that if this is good theatre, then theatre in Melbourne's not very good, or even if it is, maybe they just don't really like this theatre thing. Yeah. Maybe it's not for them.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to be the case with any review. Like things that I adore, somebody's going to go and go, God, that sucks. But I think at that time, when was that? Was it 2006?
November 25th.
My past is coming for me. No, it was 2006.
Yes.
Because I think part of the anger I felt at the time was that thing about there being like two places where reviews appeared and were attended to at that time. And so there's no multiplicity of voices. There's no one to say, that sucked. I know, you know, The Age liked it, but publicly, here it is, this sucks. There's a conversation now, which there wasn't back then. And so that frustration was years and years of seeing, to my mind, the most dull conventional theatre elevated at the expense of new or interesting or even just really well done energies. And so, yeah, like I said, I'm not sure I can defend it, but I know exactly where it was coming from.
Heard you reference a quote from David Mamet's essay about calling for critics to be part of theatre culture rather than above it. And this can be really hard, particularly when negative reviews come out. It's hard to be a part of that culture as well. And I've spoken to Jane Howard a lot, for example, about how resistant Adelaide artists can be to this, how they're so wary and keep her at such a distance, which I think is changing. But how do you think this mission, as a mission statement, how do you think that affects your writing about theatre?
Well, I think that I came into, as I said, I came to reviewing by chance. Mm. It wasn't something I intended to do. I fell into it. I got offered a job, and then I discovered I really liked thinking about performance and trying to write about performance. And then there was a 30-year journey of learning and failing and learning and failing as you learn anything. But the thing was, I began my kind of creative life as a poet, and as a young poet when I was about 18, I worked for maybe 10 years with an editor. I knew I didn't know about my art and my craft, and this very generous man, John Leonard, who is now a publisher of poetry, I owe a great deal to for the really rigorous criticism. I'd go around there like once a month with my poems. They'd tell me, well, that doesn't work and you should do this and what about that. But I was really hungry for it because it was a long and painful thing for me to learn how to self-criticise. Mm. I was always a very intuitive artist. So when I first started writing criticism, I naively thought that everybody wanted that kind of criticism because I'd certainly gone looking for it and found it and used it to grow. And I was really very taken aback when I discovered that it wasn't welcome very often. I mean, you know, all young critics can be very tough. But, yeah, I was really surprised. I was very naive. So later when I started Theatre Notes, I wasn't naive anymore. I knew that was the case. And I'd also been unintentionally controversial in the poetry world. Like every time I wrote a poetry review, someone would have a hissy fit and I'd be hated for decades, and I didn't mean to do this, but there was a thing about the paucity of honest criticism in Australian culture. And so I think for me there's no conflict of interest. It's like if you're serious about the work, I mean, it doesn't mean I'm right. No critic is ever right, and no critic can be considered to be right. That's ridiculous. But you have to be honest, and if that causes problems, if the artist won't ever speak to you again, well, so be it.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Like that's the price, and bad luck. You know, often it's a bit sticky. That, you know, Melbourne is so small. I've been around so long. You know, almost everyone. Mm. Some of them are my friends, and so you do have those circumstances where things can get a little bit stiff for a few months or something. But it's a very good test of friendship, I have to say.
Yeah.
You know, and I it can't be comfy. It can't be cozy.
Mm.
Jane's.
Although reviewers do make excellent drinking companions, and I think more artists should drink with reviewers because I think it just helps those things along.
It does.
I'm wholeheartedly just an advocate for getting drunk with your reviewers.
What do you think is the cause behind this, as you say, paucity of criticism in the Australian culture?
I think when I started Theatre Notes, one of the things in the early couple of years, nobody was taking much notice of it. It was just, you know, everyone was, what's a blog? But, of course, the people I wrote about took notice. And I got two or three emails from young directors or people who I'd been quite tough about, who wrote to me saying, thank you, you know, for, well, basically taking notice and hopefully being accurate, because reviews do have to be accurate. Judgment isn't about accuracy, by the way. I was being very judgmental. It's a different thing. But being accurate, because I've been reviewed where it's not accurate. This isn't about whether something's liked or not. It's about you getting this really windy feeling that you didn't do that thing that you thought you did, and then going and checking, or something appears that you didn't do. You know, those kinds of things, that's what accuracy is for me. But if you look at the discussions around literary culture, and certainly in poetry, it's really vexed, which isn't to say there's not good critics around. There are. There's good literary critics. But I've always found theatre I think it's a more robust art form, because people literally do have to go out and stand in front of other people and do their stuff, and the audience is right there, as opposed to, say, literary culture, where they can, you know, 3 years later your book might come out and somebody might write about it. There's this real reluctance to actually exchange ideas and to have the kinds of conversations that we do have in Melbourne. And in fact, there's this kind of idea that you mustn't, or you can't, or those conversations aren't possible.
Mm. Do you think that is what's behind the idea of anonymous reviewing of literary works? Do you remember in 2009, I think it was, when Jane Simmons...
Yes, we all remember that.
And she was a high profile, shall we say. Well, I don't know how high profile she was, because she was in Sydney and we in Melbourne don't know anything about Sydney. But she was an anonymous, very cruel reviewer of work.
Yeah. I don't think she was high profile. I think that's why everyone got pissed off. You know, like James Waits was reviewing.
But her anonymity was one of the sticking points.
It was. I think in the culture that did grow up around blogging, there was and remains a real sense that people who write about performance, you know, it's them.
Can I ask, you on your blog, in your comments, there's always a lot of people who comment, who say very nasty things often, who are anonymous or have sort of funny nicknames. And see, I don't allow that really on my blog. I find that very cowardly. But you let them be. How do you feel about them? Those people.
Oh, sometimes they were very annoying. It was a constant question when I was doing theatre notes whether to not to allow anonymous commenters. But the thing is, I had quite a few anonymous commenters who were perfectly civilised people who came in and talked, and sometimes I knew who they were, and I kind of valued their input, and so I never quite did it. And also, some of the most offensive things that were said to me were by people who were not anonymous, who did it under their own name. So I, you know, the idea that
we know who you're referring to.
No, not merely that.
Yeah.
Other cases, all men, I might say.
Yeah. But it's interesting as well, because so often, we talked about this a little bit with Rob as well, but so often critics talk about wanting to start a conversation, and often it's a conversation that the artists that made the work aren't necessarily ready to have. And well, Rob mentioned that he sent you an email once in response to a review, but wouldn't have that in a public forum, actually put that out there as history. Like, how do you feel about artists responding to work? Is that something you want them to be talking back about?
Well, I always felt that they ought to if they wanted to. I mean, I think it's wholly understandable that artists might not want to.
Yeah.
And might feel really awkward, especially in a public place, in having those conversations. Some artists don't. Most artists do feel awkward about it.
Yeah.
And some critics feel that artists should feel awkward about it and shouldn't do it. And I always felt that, of course, artists should have the space to say what they liked if they and have that conversation if they desired. I mean, I can't see anything wrong with it. It seems to me a really interesting thing.
Going back to that same essay that you wrote in The Overland, which is beautiful and everyone should track it down, But you concluded that memory, even mine, isn't wholly a function of the written word. We can't recover the capacity for memory, and we can't unlock time from its linear chains. It's such a beautiful sentiment. And again, I think it ties into the inadequacies of documentation, and that no matter how hard we try, we'll never wholly be able to recreate the live moment. We try our hardest, but we, in the end, do have to let it slip through our fingers and let it, to a certain extent, although to fully give up and go, well, that's gone, what's past is past, is also a monumental loss to us as an artistic community. But you've spoken as well about the difficulties of, like, as a reviewer, your main medium is words, and theatre is something that brings together words and images and emotions.
And set design.
And all of this stuff that's difficult to sum up. So
yeah.
I guess standing here sort of as we wrap up, how do you feel that your contribution to history will be? Like, where will that...
That's an epic
question that I didn't even... It was so epic I, like, chickened out of it halfway through the sentence. But like,
contribution to history. I suppose the reason I like the overnight review idea. I like the thing that you go to the theatre, you come home, and over the course of the next few days, often on Theatre Notes, it was like a week, you write down your response to that, your immediate response to that particular evening that you were at. And I think that's a really valuable way of logging history. And there must be lots of different people because... obviously, you know, there's Cameron loving the show that I think is the worst thing that's ever been done in the world in space. But that's really important, you know, that I can get all categorical and say, this is dreadful, and then there's somebody else saying, no, it wasn't. And what there mustn't be is one singular discourse that then says, this is how it was. And that, I suppose that's what I've always felt most hostile towards. But in personal terms, I mean... It's funny thinking of Theatre Notes because it's a kind of diary.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
There's a lot of you in it.
Yeah.
It's a really active presence.
Yeah, and, you know, I loved doing the blog and just sort of mucking around playing. Yeah. You know, a lot of it was play. But being able to take that, on the one hand, quite personal response, letting go of the fiction that critics, I think, less and less are maintaining that they are the objective judges of whatever art happens at, you know, around their feet, and entering much more into the flux of the moment. You have the moment passes, it must pass, because as you said at the beginning, it's mortal.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's true of all art actually, but it's why theatre and performance are so extraordinary and so beautiful, and why I do love writing about them.
It's beautiful.
Can I? Because we actually have about 5 minutes left. I wanted to ask you a couple of really short questions here. Since, as someone who has been watching theatre for a long time, what do you think are the aesthetic constants in the Australian theatre, things that are particular and that we return to?
Oh, gosh. Again? I don't know whether there are.
This is a very serious podcast.
Yeah. I think Australian theatre at its best is... I mean, there is a good side to not being crushed by culture. In Europe, you're really aware of all the centuries and centuries of Western culture, and it's all been done. And one of the beautiful things about Australian writing and culture and performance is this sense that that's not hanging over everybody. I think at its best, there's a tremendous freedom in Australian performance and a huge intelligence and a kind of disrespect that's really healthy.
And what do you think are the things that Australian theatre keeps forgetting of its history that it keeps having to learn again and again?
That it's often been disrespectful and intelligence and all the things that it has. It's important that it has a tradition that exists.
And how would you like this time to be remembered? 100 years from now, when someone looks at theatre in Australia?
Oh, you know, like Paris 1914. About the same size.
I hope we're all illustrated with incredible 1914 haircuts as well.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Alison. So our guest today has been Alison Croghan, and we'll continue to explore the question of how Australian theatre remembers its history and shapes its future in the next episodes. You can find us on iTunes and through our website, which is audiostage.gorillasemiotics.com.
Thank you.